Welcome, everyone, back to the Brocast. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 24/7 Sports Network, and I am joined on this fine Thursday morning by Tracy Pearson. Tracy, how are you?
I'm good, Dave. How are you?
I'm splendid.
Are you freezing down there? And
brutally cold.
Yeah.
Brutally cold. It's like, I want to say 63 degrees right now, and it's only going to get up to about 79 today.
You know, the people that really need to temper themselves are those that you just see and they go, ah, it's just too warm. I want it to be cold.
I mean, it was 85 yesterday and I was saying that.
Let's just go with it. Let's just roll with this and just and value it when the rest of the country's freezing its ass off.
I just want 68, man. Is it too much to ask for 68?
Plus, it always helps UCLA football and basketball, you know, when the weather out here is great and the rest of the country stinks. So
the weather outside is nice.
That was the trend. That was the segue.
I liked it. It was good.
Thank you.
We have a lot to talk about today. We wanted to talk about our Bob Ochesney interview from last week with Derek Ray. We wanted to talk about our visit to UCLA on Saturday for the Bruin Bash and the
Indiana, to watch my son speak.
Correct.
Yeah.
The Indiana basketball game. And then we wanted to talk about the basketball team generally, both men's and women's. And then maybe finish up with some depth chart discussions from the series I am writing about the football transfers. So, Tracy.
Yes, Dave.
Friday last week, we spoke with Bob Ochesney and Derek Ray for a nice 30-minute conversation right after they got in off the road. I do want to tell people, like, this was initially, just a little peek behind the curtain, this was initially planned as like a 10-minute call, but it extended all the way to 30 minutes, and it was literally right after they got in off the road from doing what was basically a marathon series of visits to a bunch of local high schools and right before they were getting ready for the junior day the following day. So really kind of awesome and gracious for them to afford us that much time at that point in the insane recruiting cycle.
Which Coach Ochesney let us know when he was speaking at the Bruin Bash.
Correct.
Telling everyone about his schedule. You know, there was the transfer portal. Then I've been on the road. I went to Hawaii. I went to Seattle. I went to Phoenix. Then I land in the building. And what do I got to do? An immediate podcast with those two slappies in the back of the room.
Correct. Yeah. And it was delightful. It was but delightful. Yeah,
I think he didn't call slappies. I made that up. He was very, very gracious.
He was great. Yeah. But it was really good. That was kind of our first time really talking to him beyond a little, you know, question here or there. So that was good. I thought Derek Ray was very professional. He was very serious, very serious minded fella. But it was a good interview. If you haven't checked it out, go dive into it. It's a nice 30 minutes about basically everything to do with the transfer portal. We're hoping to talk to Coach Ochesney again later on in the spring in advance of spring football. And then we went to the Bruin Bash on Saturday, Tracy, prior to the Indiana game. That was a pretty cool environment as well. Ochesney spoke there as well. We posted the video from that as well. He was really, really good in that setting. There were mic malfunctions, the whole thing. But he was answering questions really, really frankly. Like it was, what I've noticed with him is it's a lot of honesty, like a lot of honesty responding to people's questions. And it's just like, I'm not quite used to that. I mean, from a football coach, obviously we get it from Mick Cronin, maybe a little too honest at times. But Ochesney, a lot of just like kind of honest appraisals of the situation and like speaking frankly about the state of college football and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. It's kind of refreshing.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, he got in depth a bit, if you didn't see the video, about NIL, about him stepping up into a whole different NIL environment, and was completely frank about the challenges. But you know what's really interesting about it is he can be very candid, but he laces in optimism too, which is really unique. That, you know, if you want to generate buy-in, the way to do it is to do exactly that. You talk about, frankly, about what things are like. So everyone goes, yeah, I agree. And then yeah, top it off with some optimism. So now everyone's bought in. So he's got that public speaking thing down. I don't think there's been a situation we've seen him in, including the timeout in the first half of the game when he walked onto the John Wooden court and pretty much told the crowd that UCLA was going to win a Big Ten football championship.
Yeah.
Without doing much more than that, I mean, he had that crowd rocking. He even stopped speaking, and you could hear the energy in the crowd building from what he had already said. So he knows how to do this really, really well. So I know a lot of people would say, well, you know, can he coach? Do we know about his coaching? And honestly, there's some uncertainty there. But a big part of
is
this...
there? What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, to coach at this level. Let's just say that's still not quite 100% certain. But a lot of the job, though, is doing what he's been doing at UCLA. We, you know, not to be detrimental towards Deshaun Foster, but we saw what it can do to a program when you don't have this aspect of the job down. And Chesney absolutely does. We have not, like I said, we haven't seen him in a situation where he has struggled at all.
Yeah. It was a tour de force. But we have all the videos from those different appearances up on the site as well. I recommend listening to all of them because they're all a little bit different. I mean, I think the way he spoke to us was obviously different and more measured and, you know, all that than he was at the Bruin Bash the next morning. And then he was even more pumped and, you know, kind of a rah, rah guy at the basketball game. But it was all the appropriate, you know, the appropriate approach for each of those environments. So yeah, to Tracy's point, seems very, very comfortable in all those situations.
A couple of interesting highlights I found in our interview with him. So far he has come off when we've seen him in interviews as, like I said, pretty positive, but I'm always suspect of someone who's always positive. I think they're hiding something, but I got a little bit of edge from Coach Chesney, which I really liked. When I said, so you're out there, you know, you're driving too on the freeway, driving around to high schools instead of just letting Derek drive. And he said something like, yeah, Tracy, I know how to drive a car.
I've driven a car before.
Tracy. I've driven a car before, which was great. We like, you know, we like that kind of edge. So I that was like a big highlight. What else, Dave? There were a couple others. I kind of don't want to say this, but I think it's kind of interesting. He knows so much so quickly about UCLA. Fours up, saying all the right things, not stumbling. When we did, when the representative of the UCLA Alumni Association did an 8-clap. He hadn't gotten that down yet, which was really fun to watch. But it, amazingly so, he had it down by the end of the 8-clap. So fast learner.
Yeah.
Yeah. So really, really a fun time. You know, our site is always built on hope. You know, we originally established this whole site on recruiting. And that's basically selling hope. And I think he's doing it very effectively so far.
And I will say just, you know, Chesney aside, the Bruin Bash was pretty cool. I think speaking for Tracy, but for both of us, seeing so many bro subscribers there and like talking to so many of them, it was just really kind of warming feeling. It was just nice and cozy. It felt like, you know, a bunch of people we know, and it was just cool to see all of I'm sure many of you are listening, all of you out there, and you know, exchanging words and
how knowledgeable everyone is.
Because, oh my god, right. So you could tell, so like there were Chesney opened it up for Q&A at one point, and you could tell, like, the people who were bro subscribers asking questions, because they were extremely, like, knowledgeable and incisive about a particular point. And then you kind of tell who wasn't, because there'd be some kind of, like, just general thing. But it was really, and then we asked him afterwards, are you a bro subscriber? And they're like, oh yeah, of course. That's why I was able to ask that question. That was just really cool. And then we talked at it too. And it was great.
We
brought the house down.
We destroyed Chesney after he left.
Obviously. Yeah. Yeah. We got him out of the room because he was just too embarrassed.
Yeah.
Yeah, what great planning. Thank you. Thank you, Greg, and the Alumni Association for putting us after Chesney.
Actually, thank you, Greg, for letting us speak.
We appreciate you. It was very good. And we got some good questions from the bros, so it was a lot of fun. All right, so that was the Bruin Bash, but there was also obviously the basketball game that day. So we should probably talk about that. This was another cool thing, and not to make this like too much about just like the environment and atmosphere, but we had organized kind of what turned into Bro 3 sections of the 109, 110, and 111 sections of Poly Pavilion. So I was sitting in the stands with a few people who were close to me in the Bro section. From a fan watching standpoint, that game was super fun. Obviously, it didn't end the right way, but double overtime, the Trent Perry shot at the end of regulation, just the multiple swings. That was like, it was so interesting because I've been to now literally two games in the last 10 years at Pauly, right?
And within the last month.
So I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh, this crowd's pretty good. This is actually a pretty good atmosphere. And then I'm reading all these people on the board who are like, oh, this atmosphere sucks. There's nobody there. And I'm like, and some of them were people at the game. And I'm like, maybe this is just me being like, you know, this is like a relatively fresh experience for me now. But I'm like, this environment actually is pretty good for that
game. You know what's strange about it is, if you look around the arena, it takes UCLA fans so long to fill Poly Pavilion. So
yeah, and I think that it. Yeah.
There's so many empty seats. And even 10 minutes into the game, there's still so many empty seats. So I think people take that away saying, this isn't a great environment. But if you just go by the fans cheering and the decibel level, and it's fine. It's good.
Yeah,
I think it's just the attendance of filling out. There's so many empty seats. There's so many people who own seats that don't show up.
Yeah, but I would say by like, I mean, obviously at the end of the game, I think it was like plenty loud in there. And like people were saying, oh, the Indiana fans outnumbered UCLA fans. And I'm like, I didn't
see that at all.
It was very distinctly like it was overwhelmingly like white shirts in there. Like it was the whiteout actually, I think, went pretty well. Like it wasn't like exclusively a white shirted event, but it was like I would say 80%.
And to be just frank, Indiana fans were good there, but I've heard other fans louder than the Indiana.
100%, 100%. I've heard Cal Poly fans louder than the Indiana fans. I thought it was actually a pretty good environment, and honestly, I had a ton of fun watching the game. It really kind of back to like student level, like, you know, jumping out of my seat, the whole thing.
That's right. You want to talk about that game?
Yeah. So, the game itself, like when you take off the like fan hat and, you know,
Dave did have a fan hat on. It was very cute.
I had a literal hat on. But I bought a shirt at the student store before the game because I don't own a white UCLA shirt.
You're such a fan.
I know. It's not like college when like my wardrobe was 70% UCLA stuff. Like I was a friggin' athlete. So the game itself, I would say before I get into like things that I thought were like, you know, bad about UCLA's performance or whatever, there is the elephant in the room that we're maybe not discussing enough is the absence of Sky Clark. And I think it was particularly felt in the second half of that game because I just don't think they had the depth or they don't have the bench that Cronin is very willing to play. And so I think there was fatigue definitely played a factor in this game, particularly on the defensive end. Like in any other situation, Trent Perry gets pulled at some point, even with the shot making, even what he was doing offensively, because he kept letting that dude dribble right and just body him over and over and over again for layups. And it's just that wouldn't, I think if Sky Clark is available, that doesn't continue to happen because Trent gets, you know, a breather at the very minimum on the bench, but he wasn't, but they weren't going to do that in this game.
On the other hand, he might not have been in the game to hit that,
to hit the big shot, yeah. Which was very similar to the Jaime Jaquez shot against ASU his freshman year. Just didn't quite turn out the same.
Yeah. Way. I mean, I agree with that first point. They were gassed.
Super gassed.
I mean, by the second overtime, Donovan Dennett played all 50. I don't think I've ever remember in two overtimes that a player played every minute. Well, I think there was like 20 seconds he didn't play.
Yeah.
That was phenomenal, but they were clearly gassed. So to me, that game was like what you said. It was just a lack of bench.
Yeah. If Sky Clark's available, I think they probably win it, but also, defensively, it just was not a good performance starting basically at halftime on. And yes, some of it was being gassed and the whole thing, but I would also say focus was poor. Like there was some stuff where it was just like, look, Trent, I get that you're tired. How are you not cutting him off from going right? Like just get your body over there, make him cheat left, make him have to go that way, no matter what you're doing. But he just kept letting it happen and kept getting bodied every single time. And it was just, okay, then what are we doing to compensate for this? And then in addition to that, constant helping off of the corners from UCLA players, where it was this over-helping to prevent dribble drive, leaving wide open shooters in the corners. And this Indiana team was a really, really good shooting team coming in. That could not have been the game plan. Like, couldn't have been.
Right. And then no kind of rim protection in the end, and just letting the just continually drive and get into the paint. Yeah, it's, you know, I just did the review of the Rutgers game, and I've written this a couple of times this year. It's like what you just described of Trent Perry. Most of the time with the Mick Cronin team, there's maybe one or two guys who aren't great defenders and we will pick them apart. This team it's pervasive among, there are just so many guys that aren't great defenders. And that means that they're just naturally not a great defender. They don't play with a high focus or defensive energy. And that's predominant on this team this year. And it's so disorienting for me just to watch. As it was in that second half against Indiana, and like what it really was in their blowout against Rutgers. It's a different entire team that we have to get accustomed. And it's taken me to this point. I'm still not accustomed. Like against Rutgers, they beat them by 30, but that was just all offense, 100% offense with not a very good defensive showing, and they didn't need it. So it's a strange team to me this year.
And very strange.
And it shows its vulnerability like against Indiana. It won't show it against a team like Rutgers, where, I mean, Rutgers is just plainly not very good and they're really young. So, and then UCLA executed its half court offense just incredibly so efficiently. So you don't see it. But dang, it really to me was the reason. Like, yeah, they were gassed, but they're just, the defense was just really, really poor. Mick Cronin said after the game, the entire game, they didn't play good defense. And I thought they played decently for what, the first 15 minutes.
Yeah. I think he was being, emotionally reactive, and that's fine. But the thing, I think defense was obviously a huge issue. I do want to bring it up just because I brought it up in the review. I do think it's valid, and I don't, like, I get people who are like, really negative on the program right now and really negative on Cronin. They don't want to hear this, but like, it's insane the home whistle that UCLA gets. Like, it's crazy when you see the like home cooking that other schools get, and then what happens to UCLA sometimes on its home floor is just nuts. Like, the second overtime, I don't think there was a single, and it was nothing but 50-50 calls, and almost every single one of them, maybe every single one of them, went against UCLA. It was, because my thing on the out of bounds, I watched the replay afterwards, and I'm like, okay, I get how people are saying it's conclusive that it went off the Indiana player, but I can also see how it could go either way. But how is the initial whistle when it's bang, bang, how is the initial call Indiana? Because it's bang, bang. You're on the, you're at UCLA. You've already like obviously screwed UCLA on like four straight calls going into that play. Like, I get the officiating thing. How do you not trying to even things out at the end if it's all bang, bang stuff? And it's just like, this is the stuff where I just don't really get what's going on, because you have the Jamar Brown rebound on the loose ball, which was a clean rebound, but okay, they call a foul. You have the guy who went over the back of Eric Daly, where they somehow called a foul on Eric Daly. You have the two fouls on Tyler Bilodeau. The first one, fine. The second one, I don't even know what they were watching. And it's just, how do all of those go against UCLA? Like, just make it even. It's just, I don't know. It's bizarre, honestly. It doesn't seem like UCLA ever quite gets anything close to the home cooking that many Big Ten schools get on their home floors. And it's just, I don't really understand it, but it does make, it makes it another thing where it's just like, what's UCLA doing in this league? Like, it's so stupid, because obviously it has something to do with that, but it's bizarre to watch.
Yeah, I mean, come on, the Pac-12 reffing was notorious. I know what you're saying, and I think there is some home cooking, but I think it's erratic. I think it's just basically there's some really bad officiating going on. I think that's the majority of it. I don't know if there's necessarily home cooking all the time at certain venues, but I think it's just bad, Dave. I mean, there's so many times when I've been watching a game and you look at the ref and you can just see that he had no angle on it. He didn't know what he was doing. He made a desperation call because he didn't know what it's just bad officiating.
Yeah.
I think that's about 80% of it.
And then the out of bounds play itself, obviously Dent fell asleep. The question is, do you zone that? Do you man it? I don't really have a dog in that fight. I do think, you know, having somebody under the basket is important. Yeah. And you can avoid defending the inbounds.
And then a few days later, we get the Rutgers game, which was, you might have said, you know, when you get emotionally deflated like the Indiana game, you might not come back and be able to play at a level of focus. But Rutgers was really bad, which really helps. I mean, Eric Daly had two freshmen guarding him, and it literally was like a couple of kids guarding a man. I mean, he'd just take a couple of dribbles, shoulder the guy, bounce off him. He'd get 4 feet of space and make a 12 footer. I mean, it was a really good matchup to have right then. UCLA's half court is amazing. They scored 98 points, and you could make the argument there wasn't one transition basket, maybe a couple where they broke that really crappy Rutgers press, but 98 points without transition basketball. That is some amazing half court execution. Two turnovers in the entire game. Obviously, Tyler Bilodeau scored most of his points in the first half and only played like 13 minutes in the second half. I want to talk about him a little, because we were Bilodeau critics, and we can still point out certain aspects of the game, mostly defensively, when he's just average.
He's playing harder, though.
He is playing harder. But his offense, this is otherworldly.
Yeah,
this is what you do when you're a good offensive player, but you're not that great defensively, if your only avenue forward is to really take your offensive game to a whole new level, which he has done. His shooting ability has improved. He was a good shooter last year. He's a really high level shooter this year from wherever he catches the ball. He's got to be one of the best pick and pop guys in the country. Shooting 44% from three, 50% from the field, and like 88 or 89% from, so he's a 50, 40, 90. And there aren't too many of those guys that really exist. When he catches the ball, wherever he catches it, you think he's one of those guys that you automatically think is going in.
Yeah.
And last year he did a lot of his damage around in the paint around, on the block. This year he's doing it at all three levels. So, and being able to draw fouls and just knock last year. Remember there were times when he missed some big free throws. He is knocking them down this year. So a lot of kudos to Tyler Bilodeau.
Well, and he's already, I brought this up the last time we talked about Bilodeau, but he's already shot 10 more free throws this year than he shot all of last year.
That's amazing.
His free throw rate is almost double what it was last year.
Yeah.
His offensive game, like he's gone from a guy who, you actually had the point where it's, well, when he's not scoring, you can't have him on the floor. But now he's always scoring. Like he's always scoring. So obviously you have him on the floor all the time. And I will say he's playing harder defensively. I don't know if he's like a whole lot better, but he's playing harder consistently on defense. But I mean, the scoring is at a level like, I mean, he looks like vintage Don McLean out there. Like yeah. It's not just the shooting. Like he's scoring. Like he's a scorer. Like he's making it in a lot of different ways. He's making like, it's not just contested. He's scoring. It's weird. He's shooting through contact and making it very regularly. It's one of the strangest things. I think he's gotten physically stronger. I'm guessing his lower body feels a lot better than it did last year. Because he just looks a lot stronger, finishing through contact. The end result is, I mean, his splits are insane, as Tracy pointed out. I think a big factor also is he's playing with a real point guard. Playing with Donovan Dent helps a lot. He's getting the ball in much more advantageous position and also quickly. Like, he's getting the ball with a purpose. Rather than just kind of getting it swung to him at the end of the shot clock and then hope for the best. Like the pick and pop stuff, like all that stuff, it's happening quickly at the time it's supposed to. And then he's able to catch and shoot. He's obviously worked so much on his game that like, that's basically automatic. I'm surprised when he misses.
I'm still a little surprised when he's left open.
Why is anybody they should be always like in his shirt? He makes shots, but
he can't take you off the dribble. Extend your defense on him so he can't get his. There have been times when he has taken a three from a few more feet away and he's out of his range, or someone is in his face and he misses his. I don't get why you wouldn't just extend, get a guy on him. On the pick and pop, who do you care? What would you rather do? Have Donovan Dent take the ball to the hoop, or feed Bilodeau on a three from a pick and pop? I'd rather put someone right in the face of Bilodeau. So I don't get defenses against him. Oftentimes, he catches the ball in the post now, and he's not doubled.
Yeah,
I don't get. The defense against him. But let's keep it going. Shh. Don't tell anyone. along those same lines. And I wrote this, I don't get why you wouldn't close out. And this was a choice. It might be with Bilodeau that you just can't execute it. Why you would never close out on Xavier Booker. He's shooting 42 or 43%. He catches 44. The ball. It's now at 44.
After actually, that game. No, it's now, no, it shot up to 48 after that game.
No,
48% from three.
He seriously, like I wrote, could have a cup of coffee. It takes so long, No one ever closes out on. I think at the end of he hit that corner three, and someone actually tried to close out on him in against Rutgers. I mean, he's not taking you off the dribble. If you extend your big, is it really making you that vulnerable to dribble penetration against UCLA? Really? I don't get it. But he had his coming out offensively. He also did it inside because, you know, Rutgers, again, is not good. They had a 6'8", maybe 6'7", 215-pound guy trying to defend him most of the game, and he just either dunked it or laid it in. So that was a good development too, but it was mostly a lack of defense from Rutgers that led to that. It might be a little bit of a fool's gold. If anyone mounts a decent defense against UCLA, I don't think you're going to see that kind of offensive execution, but it was fun for a game. I mean, it was at least fun for the fans. I know it was probably fun for the players too.
Rutgers is literally the worst team in the Big Ten.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Just so we know.
Looking ahead, Washington comes to town on Saturday. You know, UCLA beat them up there in Seattle earlier in the year.
Very tough game.
Tough game. They've been playing about like what you would expect recently. They just lost to Iowa. They beat Northwestern. They haven't been blown like Illinois. They lost by 9 points at Illinois. So they're not getting blown out. They're playing solid basketball. I think they're playing better than what when we saw them. They didn't really know who they were, but they still aren't that great. They're in the bottom, I think, quadrant of the Big Ten standings right now. I think the key to this game, I have to expect Sky Clark makes a return. You'd want him back in the lineup just to shake off the rust before going on that hellish road trip to the state of Michigan. So I think we might see him probably come off the bench maybe for some minutes. If not, wow. If his first game, he walks into Ann Arbor next week, that would be tough to be his first game back. So I think that's the thing to really look for against Washington on Saturday is Sky Clark's return. I'm not necessarily saying this. We have a little bit of information, but we've had that information for a while. This is just me semi-speculating. It sounded like Cronin thought he might be able to return against Rutgers, but I think, you know, a good move. You didn't have to play him against Rutgers.
Okay.
And then after that, Dave, there is Michigan, at Michigan State. Illinois, which is ranked. So that's Michigan, the number two team in the country. Michigan State, number 10. Which did just lose at Minnesota, which is something I need to point out after I get through this. And then Illinois, number 5 at Pauley. That's going to be a tough little gauntlet right there, I'm thinking. They don't match up well against Michigan. This team, the way this version of a Cronin team doesn't match up well against Michigan State, it actually matches up better against Illinois. But that is going to be a tough, tough, tough three games.
And if you don't know, Illinois has a couple of old friends on it, Andre Stojakovic and Kylan Boswell.
Yeah, that we feel like we've known for like 10 years. Right. Dave, you missed another old friend on that road trip. This was your guy.
What?
He's 7'3".
Oh yeah. Yeah. Adai Mara. Yeah, he's still 7'3".
Yeah.
He'll always be 7'3".
So I did a story earlier this week about how UCLA gets into that NCAA tournament. We will admit this is just strange that we were talking about trying to get into the Elite Eight of the preseason. Now we're literally talking about how UCLA gets off the bubble. It has quad one games at Michigan, at Michigan State, Illinois, at USC and Nebraska, and Dave, Minnesota just edged its way. That away game at Minnesota, they're now 72 in net. So that becomes a quad one opportunity.
It might be not by then, no.
Dave, let's just say it is. I mean, it literally comes down to this. If UCLA can pull out one or two quad one wins, it's in the tournament. If it can't, it's absolutely on the bubble. And the way it's quad one, quad two wins and losses, can absolutely see it being left out of the tournament. So yeah, these games are really, really important for the rest of the season.
I mean, even the Indiana game, it was quad one after they lost.
Yeah.
It's now quad two. It's a quad two loss now.
Yep.
It changes
because they lost SC, right?
And the reason this matters because it's all very stupid. The way the committee works is that they're counting quad wins. It's not based on where you rank. So like the difference between Indiana being ranked 29th and 31st is significant for UCLA's resume. If they're 29th, oh, quad one loss, no big deal. If they're 31st, quad two loss, you're crap. So it's, you know, these margins matter. And
Minnesota 73. So that would be a quad one win. They dip three spots, which is, like Dave pointed out, very feasible. It's a quad two.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's a cool system.
So damn, it is going to be a tough couple of weeks. I wouldn't necessarily, you know, then they got SC at home, but sandwiched between Illinois and Minnesota. SC was not necessarily, you know, they were splitting their games against Indiana. Elijah Arenas, the freshman, I think he went off for like 27 points or something. So he kind of emerged, and they beat Indiana. So SC is not going by any means going to be a pushover. The first game is at Pauley. Well, let's just go. Okay, so it's Michigan, Michigan State, Illinois, USC at Pauley, at Minnesota, then number 9 Nebraska at Pauley, and then at USC. That is not an easy schedule to finish off the season.
No.
Dave, so when it comes to this team, I've been wanting to address this. People have said, you know, we kind of, and I'll take most of it, we didn't really make a great call preseason on how this team would perform. And I'll just simply say, based on the talent level, there's some personnel issues, absolutely. But I figured in, I just, you know, when I'm thinking about how this team's going to do for the season, I figured that they play hard, they'd be focused, and they'd be decently on the defensive end. And that has been so erratic and inconsistent that the results have been that unpredictable just because no one could have seen that going into the season. You kind of assumed a Mick Cronin team would hit on all of those factors, and it hasn't. So, again, another reason why this has been a strange year watching this team right now, Dave, after this team right now is far worse off than last year's team, which there is no way we could have anticipated that would happen going into the season.
Yep. We've talked about this team just kind of generally, but I mean, I think the reality is that a lot of the things that, you know, we identified in April of last year kind of played out. And I think there's some things that have been a little bit more nuanced and interesting. Like Eric Daly regressing as an offensive player was not necessarily something I predicted, but the combination of him and Tyler Bilodeau as defensive players was pretty easily identifiable from last year. The lack of a five was obviously something that you were banging the drum of all offseason. And yeah, they still don't. I mean, look, Xavier Booker's played better in the last five games, but is he really the consistent answer at the five? I guess we'll find out when he plays Michigan.
And just one point about Daly and Bilodeau. Like you said, Bilodeau has played harder and better defensively. Eric Daly, even though he's moved to the three, his defense is just not nearly as good as it was last year. There are times when he just, I think effort and focus wise, it just is not there. So that's been surprising. We would have thought he might have brought more energy and focus to the season defensively, but that hasn't been the case.
And then you have Donovan Dent, who I think spent month and a half conservatively looking nothing like the player that I think everyone thought UCLA was getting from New Mexico. He's looked better of late, but he's still probably not at the level that people thought he was going to be. So I do think there's an element where if you added Sky Clark for the last nine games, I do think that there is a obvious tournament team here. They've lost games that I think they would have won with Sky Clark, I guess is my point, the last few games, because I do think they've figured some things out. But I mean, the ceiling for this team is a whole hell of a lot lower than I think I would have guessed preseason. I would have thought the ceiling with a guy like Donovan Dent, with the assumption that, you know, an elite point guard can lift all boats and all that kind of stuff, I would have thought the ceiling would be a lot higher, but I don't see it now. I think, honestly, the thing that gives this team maybe a little bit more upside is actually Xavier Booker. If he continues to play the way he has the last five games, maybe you could maybe see some sort of Ryan Hollins effect on the team or whatever, because he's got the most physical upside on the team. And if he starts to tap it more, then okay. But I don't know. I think there's just too many limitations defensively. Just even if they play hard, there's limitations because of the lack of athleticism at a few spots. And then in combination with that, Sky Clark being out for this considerable length of time, if and when he does come back, I mean, he's been out a month now. There's going to be some rust. Obviously it's been a lot worse than I think we expected. And the upside is considerably lower than I would have thought.
I slightly differ a little. I generally agree, but I think the personnel has been what we kind of thought would be. I think the thing that there's no way we can have anticipated was just the effort level and focus level, that has been lacking or been really inconsistent with this team throughout the season. I think that's been the biggest factor of why they are where they are, where they are. Anyway, let's talk about that better team.
Let's talk about the UCLA women's basketball team, which continues to just essentially murder stomp every single team they play.
Yeah.
This past week they beat Iowa, very good Iowa team, beat them bloody, 88-65, didn't feel that close, played basically a perfect game, just completely turned the water off on them. And then they murdered Rutgers yesterday by 40 in a game where I don't even think they played that great. But they just mollywopped.
Hard to get you up for Rutgers. The women's Rutgers is not a D1 team.
No, they're so bad. But I mean, it was one of those embarrassing games where I think Corey Close was a little bit different minded. If she was like a lot of the other coaches in the sport, they would have won this by like 80. But instead she was liberally using the bench and just kind of, you know, playing. I think Lauren Betts had like 14 total minutes. But just, you know, obviously trying to rotate people and keep them fresh. So they won by 40. but they could have won those. They could have picked the number to win this one by.
Yeah, it's funny how your expectation changes when a team is so good. You go to watch them play. Just watching their execution, if they don't execute one possession well, you go, oh. And then you realize how well they've been executing throughout a game. What they're doing, what they're trying to execute is the right thing in your mind. Just every how they use Lauren Betts, how the offense fills in around her with some of the best three-point shooting you could ever see from a team. Just a really, really, you know, you got to say it, a really well-coached team by Corey Close that's utilizing its talent well, put together great from a standpoint. We need better three-point shooters from last season. She went out and got them. Just a real pleasure to watch and to cheer for. Coming up on Sunday, they play on Super Bowl Sunday. It's
brutal scheduling.
Yeah, it's the battle for the Big Ten lead. UCLA is out ahead with undefeated Big Ten schedule right now, playing Michigan that has one loss. Michigan's ranked 8th. They're a good team. They score a crap load of points. I think they lead the Big Ten in scoring right ahead of UCLA. Defense isn't great. They've got one really good player who I've actually noticed early on in the season, Olivia Olson, I think her name is. And she can really, really score. I think she's like 6'1". She's not like a perimeter player. She scores around the basket. That could be a tough matchup for UCLA, even though their defense, UCLA's defense has been getting better and better throughout the season. So that's a big game. And that, I mean, I don't think this is any big, you know, revelation. I'm so much more interested in watching this game than the Super Bowl mm-hmm. on Sunday. That should be a really great, great game. They are on that same road trip at Michigan and at Michigan State. For them, that's the number 8th ranked team and number 12th ranked team. So a big road trip for the women's team.
And one big thing I'd note here, and this is one where I think UCLA's experience is going to have to be an advantage here. The top 4 players for Michigan are all sophomores. Olivia Olson, Myla Holloway, Sally Swords, and Tiala DeFosse. UCLA, the top 6 players are all seniors. This is where, you know, that experience should play a big role for them going into a hostile environment, road environment. They're going to have to lean on that. I think, you know, we've gotten used to UCLA basically crushing everyone. But Illinois a couple weeks ago, and then it was, Ohio State at the end of December. They've had some closer road games. And I would anticipate these next two both potentially being pretty close games. If they emerge unscathed from these two, I think that sews up without a doubt a top seed in the NCAA tournament. And then it just becomes, you know, will they be the number 1 overall seed again, or is that going to go to UConn? But these are, the two probably biggest games of the season since early season, basically. So huge, huge, huge weekend for women's basketball.
Yeah, yeah.
Or huge weekend and then Wednesday for women's basketball. All right. Do we have anything else? Was there anything else on our agenda? Oh, we were going to talk about our depth chart series for football.
There you go.
So I'm through to edges now. I think I'm probably going to do defensive tackles today. So Tracy and I were talking, last week.
We do that.
And we were talking about like, okay, what do we actually think about, you know, where they've upgraded, where there's still some questions, and basically where we netted out is last year's team was so bad that it's basically everywhere is at minimum the same and or an obvious upgrade. But an obvious upgrade does not mean absolute good. It means relative good, right?
Relative to the team last season.
Relative to the team last year, they've made some significant upgrades.
Yeah.
But baked into that, with a lot of these position groups, there's a lot of unknowns still. And so, like, offensive line, just take that as one. Obvious upgrade, obvious, because it's not going to be, you know, Ruben Onyeka and Cortland Ford at the tackle spots, right? Like, you can stick somebody who's played college football before who's probably going to be better than those two were last year. You know, Garrett DiGiorgio has gone at guard, and there was some up and down with him, but you're probably not going to add a guy who's going to false start every single game for his entire career at one of the guard spots. So that's an upgrade. Whatever they end up doing at center, whether it's figuring out with Sam Yoon how to snap it appropriately or putting somebody else there, it's going to be an upgrade. But is it going to be good? And that's where it's still, yeah, an unknown. Because, you know, Jordan Davis at left tackle, he could be. He's played at South Alabama, and he was fine there. Is he going to be great at UCLA? Is he going to be good at UCLA? Don't know. You know, there's just a lot of that at play. And I think that's true across many different position groups. Some where it's not, I think wide receiver is an absolute upgrade, and that's based on performance. Like, you know who these guys are. You've seen them perform at a high level. And so I can see that, okay, that's an obvious upgrade. And I would say wide receiver, obviously good. You know, I really like Leland Smith. I really like Landon Ellis. You know, there's some pieces here that I really like. But I would say there's maybe a little bit more. I mean, and running back, I think, is an obvious upgrade, and I would trend towards calling it good. But I think there's more of obvious upgrade, but I don't know if they're any good. I mean, I don't know if they're going to be top level Big Ten, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You're still going through it, so you've got more to look at. But I, between you, me, and Brandon, we did so, it felt like about 1,000 of them, but we did all those commitment analyses. And, you know, we were able to go more in depth and watch a lot of tape on a lot of these guys. So I think, obviously, I would go as far right now to say the running back room is going to be good.
Yeah,
I'll just say that. I like Javian Thomas and Anthony Woods. I thought they really flashed last year without any running room. And you add Wayne Knight, Carson Cox gets a year.
I agree.
So I like that. Quarterbacks has to be an upgrade. Nico has probably got to be a year better.
And I would call that probably obviously good too.
Yeah.
I think they'll be good at quarterback.
He's good.
Yes. He's a good player.
He's good. Like you said, offensive line, it's uncertainty. It has a chance to be better. Whether that makes it good, it's tough. Eugene Brooks was its best offensive lineman last year. Let's just say he makes progress. I think center will be better. Sam Yoon is either better or there's someone better than he is. I think that will be a solid, but Sam Yoon at times, you take away the snaps. Sometimes he didn't play good games. Other times you and I said, did you watch him?
No, you are alone in this. You are alone.
You said he was good sometimes.
No, I said it in one game. Okay, one time. You are alone on this island.
Okay.
You are alone on Sandy.
You said it one time. At right guard, you're plugging in probably Riley Rebel, a guy, or Carter Swayze, really experienced in the offensive line scheme. I think that's improvement. So much of it here is going to rely on the tackles. And we go back to what Dave said. You actually got a guy who's played, who just played, and was effective in Jordan Davis. So let's go out on a limb and say, you know, that has a chance to be good.
No. Improved.
Improved.
We'll chance see on to good. Be good. Yeah.
Yeah. Tight end, just completely uncertain, I think, at this point. Yeah. No idea if they're going to, you know, last year tight ends weren't great.
No, but that's where I landed is I can't say it's going to be a downgrade because they weren't good last year.
So perhaps maybe the way to judge this is not by last season. Yeah. It's to say, will they be decent? Will they be good?
But that decent or good? But that gets too into like prediction stuff based on guys I have not seen. I have not seen them play in a UCLA uniform.
That's why we do this, Dave. That's why all these people rely on us.
Nobody is paying us. Nobody is like, okay, I want you to project this guy perfectly based on 3 minutes of highlight film.
That's what they actually do.
No, they do not want that.
They shouldn't. They shouldn't do that to us, but they do.
I refuse. I reject that reality, and I substitute my own, which is you can wait until the first week of spring, you heathens.
I'm going to go not out on a ledge for the edge. That's better. And I'm going to say they have a real chance to be good, with Sahir West. And just the guys returning, there's some talent, talent on the team from last year.
It's a good room now. Yeah. Edge is a good room.
I think the biggest question marks seriously on this team in my mind, clearly, and ain't close, is interior defensive line.
I would spot you that, but I would also say linebacker is up there for me.
Yeah, you didn't like counter me on that. You found another position.
I would say the interior of that front seven is going to be really interesting.
Yeah, Sammy Omosigo is the highest rated player transfer. Yeah, he was a 90. I was excited about him. I watched a lot of tape on him. I'm hopeful he will be able to plug in and be that Mike guy. I have some concerns. I'd say right there with running back and quarterback, I'm really confident that the safeties, I'm going to say this, Dave, the safeties are going to be good. I'd be stunned if these safeties weren't good. Scooter Jackson and Cole Martin were really good by the end of the season. And you throw in Tal Johnson, who's the most, I think, the most proven transfer that UCLA got.
Yep.
Quarterbacks, Roderick Pleasant returning was huge. I think that's big. Really key. He's kind of the linchpin. Could be good. So, I mean, what Dave and I are saying here, there's so much uncertainty. Of course, you've got 60 new players. Spring practice is going to be very enlightening.
And can I tell everyone?
Well, I just want to say this. Coming off of it, we are all, and we'll admit, you get hyped. You know, 44 players, you say, you know, they got this guy. You know, he's committed. Look, we wrote like the commitment stories. I wrote a story recently. It's just, you know, let's just reserve judgment here for a while, at least until we see him in spring.
And I want to add a little thing to that. Do you know some of the positions that are hardest to judge based on practice?
It would be offensive line.
Uh-huh. And what's the other one?
Interior
of the defensive line. Do you want to know
interior
why?
Defense? Because first off, they're way across the field. Hopefully Coach Chesney is going to let us like walk on the field,
but also practices are typically limited contact. Typically limited contact. So you're judging based off of like technique and like the way they move, but you're not really testing their violence. And at defensive tackle, especially, so much of it is how violent are you willing to get at the line of scrimmage? Like how aggressive are you with your hands? Are you willing to just rip a guy? And we're not gonna be able to tell. So This big unknown that we're talking about, this defensive tackle thing, yeah, we're gonna have some evaluations. We're gonna have some, oh wow, he looks good, and you know, looks yoked or whatever. No one's gonna have any idea until they play games.
Report.
No one's gonna have any idea about defensive tackle until they actually play games. None.
You know, but we are hoping that we're gonna be able to watch, have more to watch and
agree.
So practice during the season, there isn't a lot of contact. Understandably, you're trying to limit injury. Spring, they actually get out there and actually, you know, play at full speed and to the ground tackles. We're hoping we can actually watch that this year.
Yeah.
We haven't heard the word on it yet. Admittedly, we were given this program a lot of props in communication with us, giving us heads up about something that's happening. We ask them a question. In the past, it used to be, oh, we just don't know yet. Now they're being so helpful. It's we almost don't know what to do with it. It's been so good. But they have a lot on their plate. You know, they got a lot to do. So I all the details of spring practice have not been worked out. Given how Coach Chesney has been so far, I'd be surprised if spring practice at least wasn't open for like the first 2 weeks. If not,
don't do that.
I know. You're raising expectations.
No. You're pre-negotiating against yourself. I'd be surprised if the whole thing isn't open.
Okay, Let's just do that. I'll be surprised if we're not allowed access on the field.
Wow, there you go. Now you're talking, right?
Yeah.
Don't negotiate against yourself.
We at least should have like access to Wasserman up in that nice little comfortable balcony.
I think we should have their pre-practice reports, their depth charts. I think we should have it all.
We get the headset so we can hear.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Now you're talking.
Yeah, yeah.
No negotiating against ourselves this early.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's do that. We are so used to getting incredible access, Coach Chesney.
So used to it. It's become something that we just simply expect.
It would be amazingly a step back if we didn't get total access.
It would be very unfortunate if we didn't get a 30-minute post-practice review from the entire coaching staff every single practice.
Yeah.
It would be very unfortunate.
So there we are. You can probably expect practice, you know, we'll start when spring quarter starts, and like the first week of April.
Yeah. As is tradition at UCLA, as makes sense with the quarter system, it never made sense to start this in March and do a week or two.
And when we're talking about observation opportunity, the way they built Wasserman back in the day, you know, it's funny when we were at the Bruin Bash, I had a couple of people come up to me and go, remember back in the day when there was those bleachers out on the practice field and we all used to sit there and watch? That seems so ridiculously long ago in such a different world. The way it's built now, really, it's probably going to be lot eight. I mean, there are, you know what? I'm doing what you're saying. We should get into Wasserman, but the fan should also get Luskin balcony at least. Right, Dave?
That would be very cool if they did. They wouldn't have to bake in the sun. They could stare across.
With a cool In-N-Out food truck.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
We'll pay for the hamburgers, but just as long as they're there.
Correct.
Okay.
We're not going to pay for everyone's hamburgers.
No, I meant speaking our own. Like
people will pay for their own.
Yes, that's what I meant.
Yeah. Tracy was offering to pay for everyone's In-N-Out. You hear that? I'm protecting.
If they bring out an In-N-Out food truck, Dave, we will have a flash sale of hamburgers for like 2.5 minutes. Whatever bros are there that walk up and say magic words, we will buy them a hamburger.
Correct. Yeah. All right. That's it for us. This has been a pleasure, an honor, and a real privilege.
Both.
For Tracy Pearson, I'm David Woods, Bruin Report Online, and we will talk to you again next time.
We love you all.
Toodles.